Welcome to the Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman on signing day for high school players in college football. But real quick, Bruce, it's holiday season. People are going to holiday parties. Speaking of Trader Joe's, pick up the Jingle Jangle. It's this tin, this black tin full of candies, perfect for people, you know, getting a little handful of candy when you're mingling in the living room or having a little dessert after dinner. It's, you know, Trader Joe's does these great seasonal items. That's a very popular one.
By the way, speaking of seasonal, one food that I never paid attention to at all till I got to be, I don't know, probably like 3 years ago, which now all of a sudden I snack on way too much. So every year our kids like build gingerbread houses through school.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I just saw one, you know, just like sitting there, and I would like not eat the other stuff on it. But I actually found it's way more tasty than I ever expected.
Gingerbread?
Like, yeah. It's because of the cinnamony, I don't know. It's a snack food that I did not think at my age I would care for, and I actually do.
Well, you know, people can change. Even at your advanced age, people can change. Like we said, it's December 20th. It's signing day, which in my opinion has just gotten completely lost in the shuffle now. First they, you know, December became February, and then the portal overtook high school signing day. But there have been a few surprises starting before signing day. So Dylan Raiola is the number one rated quarterback in this class. I think up until recently, the number one overall player. First, he committed to Ohio State. Then he decommitted from Ohio State and committed to Georgia. And just in the last couple of weeks, he flipped to Nebraska, where his uncle was a standout player. So a lot of theories going around about what happened there. But I mean, what do you think is the significance in this day and age? This isn't the old days where, okay, now he's going to necessarily be the Nebraska starter for 4 years. Who knows what will happen? But yeah, I mean, Nebraska stealing away a five-star quarterback from Georgia is pretty notable.
It is. You know, you have, first of all, I've seen him in person a couple of times at Elite 11 events. And I will say this, a lot of times going to those, the really hyped guy usually is kind of underwhelming. In this case, both times I've seen him, he has more than lived up to the hype. Like, first of all, he's a very big man. He looks like he's 25, you know, physically. The ball comes out of his hand. Really, everything's easy and smooth for him, where a lot of times these guys go to these events, especially the Elite 11, where there's other touted quarterbacks and everybody's trying to make a reputation. They are like squeezing the air out of the ball. He doesn't look like he's doing that. Everything is just easy and smooth. Really impressed with him. I think it's a huge pickup for Matt Rhule. I don't even know what I would, you know, because they obviously have had some big recruits over the years come in there, but just to get a guy who is a legacy guy on top of it, you know, you have his uncle, Donovan Raiola, who is a, you know, really good NFL player as well. That was the one who played at Wisconsin. He's the offensive line coach there. So there's obviously family connections there. And I think you have a legacy here. And he's a building block. I think, you know, if you're Matt Rhule, where it was kind of an uneven first year, right? You know, there were some good things that, you know, they didn't end quite the way I thought it was going to end, where they could have got to six wins. But this guy, I think, signals to other recruits, you know, this is a destination place, and doesn't mean they're, you know, he's going to go in there and tear it up. But I think he is a, you know, he is a headliner for them, and that's what they needed.
The tricky thing about recruiting or portal talk these days is we know NIL is a part of it. We know collectives are part of it, but we don't know any details. I don't know if Dylan Raiola, what kind of NIL deal he got from Nebraska's collective, but I think it would be naive to think it wasn't a factor. And also, obviously, Georgia, I mean, his announcement that he was officially flipping was within hours, I believe, of Carson Beck announcing he's coming back for Georgia. So those are factors as well. The reason I bring up collectives again is I'm not sure there's a hotter team in recruiting and portaling right now than Oregon, Who got Dylan Gabriel from Oklahoma and Dante Moore from UCLA. Dante Moore started some games as a freshman this year, struggled. I think the assumption is he's going to Oregon fully knowing he's going to back up Dylan Gabriel for a year. And now, high school signing day, Oregon is flipping kids left and right. They have moved, according to James Crepio, their beat writer. They were number eight on 24/7 to start the day. They are now number four in the country. I've always been told, Phil Knight, Nike. I'm not sure another program has benefited more from the fact that you can now legally pay college athletes.
Well, the big flip earlier today, as we're taping this, Jeremiah McClellan, who's a really good receiver from Missouri, had been committed to Ohio State. They get him. Obviously,
And now they've got Ryan Pelham flipped from USC to Oregon. It's receiver. They're loading. First, they loaded up on quarterback. Now they're loading up on receivers.
yeah, Pelham's a was a lo is a Long Beach kid, and I think what you see, obviously, Troy Franklin had a terrific career there. And going in, I mean, we haven't talked about this on the podcast. I know we talked about it, at the Athletic, but Dylan Gabriel, really, really good fit for to me. And Max and I have, done our QB portal tracker. To me, he was the top quarterback out there because he is gets the ball out of his hand fast. He's very accurate. He can run, and he's a good fit for what they do. I mean, he makes good decisions. He's very football savvy. And I think, there's other guys that are probably maybe physically bigger, certainly, maybe have stronger arms, but I'm not sure they're as accurate. I don't know if they get the ball out as quick. And he's played a ton of football. And the idea that you're going to get there, I mean, their quarterback situation, I know we kind of talked about the Heisman the other day, and this is not the right prism for it, but I'll use it. Who would be like strong Heisman contenders for 2024? Dylan Gabriel in that offense, to me, jumps in to be a Heisman favorite, one of the Heisman favorites for the 2024 season, because I know what they have coming back and I know how he fits.
If he's as good as you say, I mean, he statistically, like,
He's the only one, by the
everything's
way, who beat Texas this year, Stu. I mean,
correct.
like, I'm the only one who's thinking he's really good.
Why then? I'm just being devil's advocate here. Why then was there a feeling around Oklahoma of it's not the end of the world if he leaves because we have Jackson Arnold?
Because I think, and knowing the Elite 11 guys, how much everybody thinks of Jackson Arnold, that
Yeah.
he is a really special quarterback prospect.
It's so hard to know now. I mean, there were five-star quarterbacks in the class of 23. Well, and Malachi Nelson, other than Arch Manning, Malachi Nelson, I believe, was the highest rated of them. And he's gone from USC after a year where it was clear they were going to recruit over him. Dante Moore obviously leaving. I say all this because I know why there's all this excitement over Raiola, but I just feel like nowadays, like Trevor Lawrence was a highly hyped five-star who played exactly that way once he got to college. Bryce Young, we can name several of those guys. But we can also name several five-star quarterbacks who barely played a down in college football. They played and they weren't as good as as people thought they were. Quinn Ewers to me is somewhere in between. He's led his team to the college football playoff, right? He's doing exactly what he was recruited to do. But you had we're going to talk about this a little bit later. You had your anonymous scouting reports have gone up on three of the playoff teams, and the opposing coach comments on Quinn Ewers were like, I don't think he's, as good as the hype. He's good, but not as good as the hype. And he was, I remember the Ari Wasserman story at the time. Had a perfect score among the 24/7 analysts. So it's just so hard to predict.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I think the hit rate is all over the board. There's some that, Caleb was a five-star, Drake May were five stars. Those guys absolutely lived up to it. And then there's other guys where maybe they needed to, it didn't work out for them at the first place, and then they end up, going somewhere else, and maybe they play like a four-star or whatever. But it's definitely, you go back. I remember one of the guys who was really hyped and was big and strong, and just, you could see where he would, people would get enamored by him, like Jacob Eason, right? Where it's like, There's guys who are measurable guys. There's guys who like light it up on the 7-on-7 circuit. There's the JT Daniels of the world who come from big programs and have played at a high level. But just, I mean, it's such an exact science. And I think in the case of Malachi Nelson, I definitely know from some people, in Southern California, really plugged in, especially on the California high school football scene, who are like, yeah, I don't know. This one has the potential where, ESPN and their recruiting rankings had him as the number one overall recruit in the entire country. You go back, this is back when I was doing the QB book. At one point, another Southern California quarterback, Ricky Town, was also the number one recruit in the entire country, not just quarterback recruit. And obviously, his career in college did not go that direction. Sometimes it does. Like obviously we mentioned Caleb, we mentioned Drake May, you mentioned Trevor Lawrence. There's like I feel like there's usually not a lot of in between. It's either.
Sam, so in the 2021 class, it was Quinn Ewers was number one. Obviously, he reclassified to get there. Caleb Williams was number two. Sam Huard was number three. Sam Huard is now at Cal Poly, correct?
Correct.
Then Drake May was behind him. And then Brock Vandegrift, who recently, after what, 3 years as a backup at Georgia, has now transferred to Kentucky.
I'm going to read to you the top eight quarterback rated quarterbacks in what was a really top heavy class. Number one, Bryce Young, obviously, absolutely that. Number two, the number two overall rated player in that class, DJ Uiagalelei. It's been
Who you
good.
would he's started a lot of college football games, but I don't think you would say he's had a five-star career.
No, CJ Stroud, absolutely. Now, CJ Stroud, this is where the rankings are a little there. You need context. CJ Stroud became that guy for a long time. When most of these quarterbacks are committing, he was not rated as that guy. He blew up at the opening. Number four, this is a name that I don't think you will, will throw you for a loop. Evan Prater, Cincinnati.
Evan Prater, I remember him. He never got the job at Cincinnati, did he?
Number five, Jaquindon Jackson, Texas. Number
Yes.
six, Hudson Card, Texas.
Now these guys, you're getting to a level now where they're not five star, right? They're just the top rated
No,
guy.
but they were all, and the last one who was a top 100 recruit, Malik Hornsby, and he was ranked number 99. But that shows you, I mean, those guys are all considered top 100 recruits, and it just shows you how tricky it is to do the rankings. Like I think it's
So with
really
that in
tough.
mind, and with your, Elite 11 connections, let's look at the ones in this year's class and see if we might be able to project a little bit.
Okay.
As we said, number one, Dylan Raiola. You feel pretty good about him?
I do. I just was very, very impressed. Now, he's not going into a place where he's going to have the weapons that you would have if you're the quarterback at Ohio State, but yes, I think he's big time.
Number two. Quarterback, number four overall prospect in the country, DJ Lagway, who's going to, he hasn't actually officially signed yet, but has been committed for some time to Florida.
Yeah, the parts I saw of him were okay. I mean, he was good. I don't remember. Like there was probably like four or five guys that I saw that really caught my eye and some other guys. It doesn't mean that they're not good players. It just didn't, it just didn't resonate the same way to me.
Number three, Julian Sayin from Carlsbad, California,
He
going to
is one of those
Alabama.
three or four. Yeah. Julian Sain was slinging it around. I was very impressed with him.
Number four, Luke Kroemenhoek, who is from Savannah, Georgia, and is going to Florida State.
I believe Luke was one of the ones who really rocketed up. He was not rated like that before. He was impressive there.
Number five, a famous last name, CJ Carr. Grandson of Lloyd Carr, surprised some that he chose Notre Dame instead of Michigan. He's already there. I've seen pictures of him practicing at Notre Dame. Your thoughts?
Liked him. I think he was one where I feel like he got better as that camp went on. Maybe the first day wasn't as smooth. I'm trying to remember, but he kept on, I think everybody feels very good about him.
And then Aaron Noland, from Fairburn, Georgia, Ohio State.
Liked him. I thought, to me, it's interesting because, I thought there was definitely some good things, and I could see him being a really good fit, honestly. He was committed to Ohio State, and I was like, oh, this guy has a chance to do some, big things there.
I think Ohio State is in an interesting situation right now because we got so used to them just moving from one superstar quarterback to the next. But with Kyle McCord transferring, you're down to Devin Brown, who will start in the Cotton Bowl against Missouri. We'll get to see what he's all about. You've got Aaron Nolan coming in, and then we assume, but it hasn't happened yet, that Ryan Day will get somebody out of the portal.
Yeah, and we'll see how it goes, because I don't know, like, from everything that we've heard, that the one of the biggest quarterback names left in the portal is Cameron Ward from Wazoo. And as we're taping this, it felt like what we're hearing is it's Miami or the NFL draft for him. Florida State, he visited. I had heard some Ohio State chatter. I don't know if how we haven't heard much of that lately. He may be leaning to go into the NFL draft, even if he'd be a fourth round pick or
So if you're
so.
Ryan Day at this point, do you maybe hold off, wait till after the spring, see,
I
kind of
know
how
they
things are
like
developing?
Devin Brown quite a bit. They're intrigued by him. So does that mean you have more confidence in him than what you think you could get out of the portal? I don't know.
It seemed like Ryan Day really wanted it to be a legit two-guy competition last year between him and McCord, but Brown was hurt and missed spring practice and kind of put him behind the eight ball there. So, anyway, a little bit in flux there.
Hey, two other guys, since we talked about this, two quarterbacks that I was very interested, very impressed by back in the Elite 11 circuit. Hoss Haney, great name. He is a really dynamic athlete who's from Texas. I think he led his school to a state championship, committed to TCU. And he's not that big, but he was very impressive. And the other one that I was impressed by, Colin Hurley, who's like really young, but he looks like physically he's a big kid. He's from Florida. He's headed to LSU. I thought he was very good. I think he's like one a name to remember for down the road.
Anything else from signing day that stands out to you? I know that Georgia flipped. Georgia's going to finish with the number one class again. And kind of rounding out the day for them was that they were able to flip KJ Bolton from Florida State.
No, I think a lot of this has been expected. Ohio State, holding on to Jeremiah Smith, who is widely considered not just the number one recruit in the country, but also probably the best receiver to come out of South Florida in a long time. And I can't tell you how heavy that kind of praise is, because South Florida cranks out receivers, elite receivers, almost differently than anybody else. And you can just look at some of the guys who've gone to Alabama in the last decade. That's a huge win for Ryan Day, where, like we mentioned, he lost another, he lost a receiver earlier, but to keep him, I think a lot of people thought he was either going to go to Florida State or Miami. And he had a bunch of teammates and buddies going to Miami. So that was significant. We got to see. I think there's some other potential drama that's out there, but
Well, I think I know what you're hinting at, and it's kind of a bigger story. Obviously, part of the Deion Sanders mystique, or what we thought would be, is oh, he's just going to be the most amazing recruiter, right? Like high school kids aren't going to be able to say no to him. Well, we know he's gone heavily in the portal direction. He only has six commitments as of this recording, six commitments, high school commitments in the class of 2024. And one of them, the biggest one of all, Jordan Seaton, five-star offensive lineman, has not actually signed yet. Amidst rumblings, this will be out of date one way or the other soon, but amidst rumblings, he may flip. Is Deion just intentionally saying we're just going to build our whole roster with current players, portal players, or is he just not able to recruit high school players?
I don't think it's not that he's able to recruit high school players. It was interesting that a couple of weeks ago we reported that his top recruiter on the staff was a defensive ends coach who had been a Georgia guy, and he was going with Fran Brown to Syracuse. And I believe that guy, Nick Williams, had, I think they had maybe eight commits, and he had been the primary recruiter for most of them. But look, the truth is, Deion needs guys who can come in and play now. And they have done well getting some guys who have a lot of seasoning on the offensive line, especially a bunch of guys who are transfers who played at the FBS level and started multiple years. And as you know, that's what they desperately need, because Shador will not survive as a, you know, not be able to stay upright with the offensive line they had. They need to get better. Now he got, a few other big time defensive players, including one from LSU, who was a former top 100 recruit defensive lineman, and they just need a ton in the trenches. And I think he's getting some of that. But again, I mean, with Shador and the skill guys they have, if they can upgrade the offensive line and get those guys in for spring ball so they can have some cohesiveness. New offensive line coach Phil Loadholt, who comes from, been at Oklahoma as a former OU player. I think that's the thing that they need most. I mean, I don't think it's any secret this they were, I don't want to say historically bad, but they were just so bad up front. And to me, getting that, like, Seton sounds like he has the athleticism and size where he was going to, wherever he goes, he'd probably be competing for a starting job. Miami had two five similarly guys, five-star offensive linemen. One, ended up starting the year at right tackle and was a terrific freshman. The other one, Samson Okolona, didn't play much. But that doesn't, it's a tricky position. It's not like you're going to come in and hit the ground running like you could at some other spots.
Colorado on 24/7 does have the number one rated portal class right now. I realize it's early and highly unscientific, but they have 16 portal commitments already. That is definitely the most. Remember last year it ended up in the 50s. I don't think he's turning over the roster quite to that extent this year,
But
but
they have good players. Like one of my freaks list guys, one of the best D linemen who was in the AAC and one of the better D linemen in the Big 12, Chidozie Nwankwo. He's a really explosive, just short nose tackle. And I think that guy will be a big player for them.
yeah, I mean, Ole Miss, I think, has kind of stolen the headlines in the transfer class so far. They've done really well. But yeah, according to this formula, it's Colorado one, Ole Miss two. Another topic we wanted to address, you and Antonio Morales did a really good and interesting story earlier this week on The Athletic of what the heck went wrong with USC this year. That was just a total implosion. And it can't be just as simple as the defense stinks. So why don't you take people through a little bit some of the main takeaways you got from the interviews you did for that story?
Yeah, it's way more involved than just, oh, the defensive coordinator didn't work out. One of the things we heard from some of the coaches we spoke to who faced them was it was a wildly undisciplined team in all sorts of ways. And it's certainly in defense. And I'm going to read you one quote, which I think sort of encapsulates a lot of things. Quote, "It was like a bunch of mercenaries trying to get their own stats. They were all over the place. You toss it outside and you'd see their guys going all over the place, so undisciplined. It was unbelievable. You had no idea what they were trying to get done. Guys in the wrong gaps, three guys in one gap, no guys in another." It just, I think it speaks to you bring in a ton of transfers, and what are you bringing in? Guys may get stats and may flash. But if they're not, defense is more than anything about playing together. And that's something that USC just really was not able to do. And then it's spread into a lot of other things where, one of the coaches had said, "Look, I thought USC has always prided itself in being so physical. That's something they hang their hat on. This team was not like that at all. We thought they were going to come downhill on us. That's what Oregon was trying to, knock us around. These guys didn't even try to." And I think If you're a USC fan, if you're a longtime USC fan, I think that's a gut punch in itself. Because if you're not even trying to be physical, because either you missed on a bunch of transfers on the offensive line, which I think they did, it leaves a mark. Because also, this came up a little bit as well, was like, it's now going to be year three for Lincoln Riley, and he's basically starting all over. And he did really well in year one. I know that they had defensive issues, which kept them from being a playoff team. And Caleb and Jordan Addison and Travis Dye masked a lot of that. But then this year, they were a 7-win team, and they probably could have lost a couple of other games there. And, even, like, there's just a lot of other stuff. Like, one of the coaches brought this up, and another coach had echoed it, where it's like you see them in pregame and they're walking around like they're an AAU basketball team. And people are like, oh, well, they did that. They looked that way last year and it worked out fine. It was like, yeah, when your culture is not exactly fully formed, or it's not a cohesive look or cohesive thing, it's the thing where that can start to fall apart when things go against you. And, another coach made the point, when you go all in on the portal and have a portal heavy team, especially if you're in like Hollywood, there's a lot of distractions there. And it's maybe easier to manage when you're in a college town where there aren't all those distractions. So, again, for people who haven't read it, I read the story. I thought Antonio, because I worked with him on it, and Antonio really wrote the piece, and he spent a lot of time talking to Lincoln Riley, and he has his sources inside the program as well. I think it's a really good window into when things go bad and why they go bad. There was one of the Pac-12 offensive coordinators told me, he was like, I played against Alex Grinch defenses before. They were not this unsound, So, it was like people can point and go, oh, they had this guy who was a five-star and this guy was whatever coming in. Yeah, they may have a lot of talent, but are they buying into playing team defense? Because if not, they may put up some numbers, but we talked about, like, Bear Alexander was a guy who flashes on film. He was a former five-star recruit from Georgia. But when they lost to Utah, he had two critical personal foul penalties that really cost them. And that's the stuff, that's the stuff when you lose games.
One thing that I don't think was people realized in the time, certainly I didn't, but that 2022 team that won 11 games, got the Pac-12 championship game, had a pretty favorable schedule Pac-12 wise. They did not play Oregon or Washington. It flipped this past year, and lo and behold, they went 7-5. In terms of the transfers, that term mercenaries is a pretty strong word, but I think the teams that have had the most success building with the portal, and that Florida State comes to mind, are doing it with guys who they held on to for several years, who weren't like rent-a-players for 1 year. And I think a lot of these USC guys, I mean, look, Jordan Addison's phenomenal, right? But nobody was under any delusion he was going to be there more than 1 year. Some of these guys were probably in a rush to get to the NFL. Like, I'm going to play well at USC and be off the NFL as soon as possible. So, I think chemistry is a real thing in college football. So it's not like you can't recruit transfers. Like, plenty of teams are doing that and having success. But I think Lincoln Riley has to figure out what the right balance is there. And by the way, speaking of the portal, it's now going in the opposite direction for USC. They've had in the last, I just feel like the last few days, some of their biggest name recruits of the last couple of years, Corey Foreman, Damani Jackson, are leaving the program. Now, neither of those guys performed up to their five-star billing.
Corey Foreman didn't even play this year. Damani Jackson is a young player, but and he's super fast, but he struggled a lot. Now he's a young
Yeah.
player. Corey Foreman didn't even, he was
He
redshirting. Like, he's, we'll see what
had a
he.
way to go. Tackett Curtis, though, played, I think he started m many games this year as a freshman linebacker. So I think, and you're seeing the same similar thing at A&M, we're in it with a coaching change. That famous highest ranked class of all time in 2022 is eroding, which a lot of us wondered what would happen, when they signed all those dudes. Evan Stewart being, about as big a name as came out of that class, now transferring. Walter Nolan was, I think, the highest ranked. He's the highest ranked transfer currently out there.
He
So,
might have been the number one player in that entire class.
But again, there's a coaching change there. It's a little more understandable. I'm definitely concerned that Lincoln Riley, as you said, 2 years in, is kind of having to start from scratch.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You've been very busy, Bruce. You've also been working on these scouting reports of the playoff teams, and the first three have gone up, Michigan, Alabama, and Texas. Highly encourage people to go on The Athletic and read them. The Michigan-Alabama thing fascinates me, and I wrote about it in the mailbag today. So somebody asked me in the mailbag, why is nobody giving Michigan a chance to beat Alabama? And I'm like, what do you mean nobody? Like, the line is Vegas is giving them a chance. They set the line at Michigan 1.5, and it's barely moved. So, you know, if everybody was betting Alabama, it would have moved by now. So clearly a lot of people are giving them a chance, but the coaches, you know, they kind of got it both ways. Like in your Michigan scouting report, the Big Ten coaches kind of dump on them, and leading some to wonder, is that because there's some sour grapes about the science? They definitely brought up science stealing. And then yes, not surprisingly, the SEC coaches all think Alabama's going to win. You've been on the Michigan bandwagon since the preseason after talking to all these people who pretty much overwhelmingly sided with Alabama. Has your opinion changed at all?
Not really. I think there's, you know, one of the head coaches I talked to basically said this, which was there's kind of three reasons for the drop in performance, especially from the offense and JJ McCarthy. And the first is the schedule is way backloaded. If you look at who they played over the last month, so the bulk of it when Jim Harbaugh was not the head coach in the games was Ohio State, Penn State, and Iowa. Those are the other three best top-rated defenses in the country. He wasn't seeing anything of that caliber before that. They weren't seeing anything. So there's that. The other part is in the beginning of that stretch, they played Penn State. Not only did he get the right tackle at Michigan, got overwhelmed a couple times by really gifted edge rushers at Penn State, two of them. And that was the game where they ran it like 30 times in a row. It's also the game where JJ McCarthy was hobbled a little bit. So word was getting around the Big Ten that he was playing banged up a little bit, and that showed. And then the third part, which is the part that I think has especially riled up Michigan fans, and I get why, is that more than a couple of the coaches I talked to all thought, you know what, maybe this is factored into they don't have the answers to the test anymore like they did before. And so JJ was operating with more confidence because he knew when the blitz was coming and maybe where the blitz was coming from. And those kinds of things can matter. So to answer your question, I still think it's a really, really good defensive line. It's a really, really good defense. I think they have really good running backs. Some of the coaches I talked to did not think Blake Corum was as explosive as he was before the injury. The stats do kind of hint at that. The offensive line, which they say is good, but not as good as it was last year. Keep in mind, they did have a significant injury. The best offensive lineman they had, Zach Zinter, he got hurt, is out for the rest of the season, got hurt in the Ohio State game. Now, what I do think they have is I think the receiving core is probably better than some of the coaches think. And I think part of that is Colston Loveland is a guy who could be a matchup problem. And he can, you know, as good as the best thing Alabama has is their secondary. Two terrific cornerbacks, Caleb Downs, safety's playing really well. I still think Michigan can give them some problems because when I talk to, SEC coaches, especially, but coaches who played Alabama, they don't think this is a great Alabama defensive front. You know, Dallas Turner can get after people on third downs, but there's no Quinnen Williams up front. There's not. And Michigan still has a really good offensive line. They are prepared to grind people out. And I do think You know, if JJ is close to 100% with his wheels, JJ can really run. Is he quite as fast as Milroe? Probably not. Milroe's the fastest guy on the Alabama team, is from what I was told. But he's still really fast. And I think, you know, he makes plays, he extends, you know, he picks up third downs. I think this team is very resilient. They're really tough. And they're, you know, I don't, you know, one thing I've heard, and it's come out, and this is, you know, mentioned in our story, was will Jim Harbaugh adjust to how he manages the team and practices to get them ready for a bowl game? Because he's lost six games in a row, and they played really poorly last year against TCU in a game that I think most of us expected them to win. And from what I've heard, he has made some adjustments. And so, you know, I'm leaning towards what Vegas is leaning towards. I know that, you know, I know what the coaches have said, but I also think, you know, especially on the Big Ten side, they were sitting on their couches to watch the SEC title game, and they saw Alabama beat Georgia, and that was the biggest win anybody's had off all season. Most of them did not see any of Alabama looking really bad and Auburn running all over them. We're not watching that game. They probably were not watching earlier in the year when some of the struggles that they had, and they had big struggles. So I think some of those guys are sitting there thinking, all right, I know what Alabama looks like, but Alabama, you know, Nick Saban knows what give Kirby Smart problems in the defense, you know, on defense, because they have the same defensive family and some of the same, you know, there's a lot of overlap there. So, you know, I think Georgia's a much better matchup for them than a lot of other teams are because of where they come from and how they're built. So, you know, again, I think there's a lot of reasons why the coaches feel the way they feel and speak about them the way they spoke about them.
I think, like, if you're focusing solely on personnel and X's and O's and all that, you can talk yourself into either team. And frankly, probably there's less question marks about Michigan than there is about Alabama. My hold up why I don't can't pick Michigan or frankly anybody to beat Alabama is the track record. And I just, you know, the definition of insanity is same thing over and over again, expecting it to go differently. Here's some stats I have in the mailbag today. SEC teams are 14-3 against non-SEC teams in the college football playoffs. So throwing out like when they played each other, including eight straight since LSU's 2019 run. Big Ten teams in the playoff, 3-6, and Ohio State with all three of those wins. Nick Saban, if you give him a month or more to prepare for a postseason game, so that's BCS championship games and now CFP semifinals, 10-1. The only one loss being Ohio State in 2014. So I just feel like I've seen this movie so many times. We try to talk ourselves into the SEC's down. This isn't Nick Saban's best team, blah, 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 blah. And then the same thing happens once they actually get out on the field. So also, I think Alabama did get a lot better over the course of the season. And, you know, you said that the coaches didn't see them struggle early in the season. I'm not sure how relevant that is
Well,
to what you're going to see out there this in the playoffs. So like,
but the week before they played Georgia, they really could have lost, and it's not a very good Auburn team.
I know, I realize that, I see that. I just think weird things happen in the Iron Bowl. It doesn't concern me as much as maybe it does some people. I just think if you look back at Alabama's season, the first half of the season, they were not very good. There's just no way around. Not only did they lose a game, but they just looked absolutely awful against South Florida. They did beat Ole Miss in that stretch. They struggled against A&M. They struggled against Arkansas. But then starting with the October 21st Tennessee game, they put themselves in a hole and then came roaring back against them, beat them by 14, beat LSU by 14.
Doesn't concern you that they gave up 250 rushing yards to Auburn?
Concerns me, yes. But again, like, I mean, their 2017 team flat out lost to Auburn in the Iron Bowl and was the four seed and got in there and won the, like, we've just seen Saban do this over and over. I mean, let's not, I don't know if there's some recency bias, like, he doesn't usually go undefeated. I think only two of his national championship teams have gone undefeated. I
I
mean,
know
think of the team that lost.
The
Think of the.
2017 team you're talking about with Auburn won 10 games. That team that they played, got blown out by New Mexico State at home. I don't think it's like the
Oh,
same.
it's definitely not the same. I think of the 2015 Alabama team that lost to Ole Miss and gave up a lot of points to Ole Miss. And all season, like, people thought, okay, this isn't one of his better teams, and they won the national championship. So I'm not ruling anything out. Michigan beats
What you're
Alabama,
saying is
Michigan
that
beats
Hugh
Alabama.
Freeze was the play caller at for Michigan this week, because that's what you basically have just walked into.
You mean because Hugh Freeze has given him so many fits?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. I didn't think about that. There's a common thread there. No, I mean, it's absolutely possible Michigan. The other thing that's just hard is, like, Michigan hasn't they didn't play any Power Five teams in the last two seasons out of conference. So the only thing you have to go by is those playoff games where they got crushed by Georgia and then lost to TCU. So they can win. They can absolutely win, but it's gonna be they're gonna have to do something that they haven't done and that, frankly, only one, Big Ten team has done against Alabama the entire time Saban's been there. Let's get to the mailbag.
As always, send your questions to the audiblepod@gmail.com.
Stu and Bruce from Ian McFarland, La Cañada, California. Stu and Bruce, a late happy Hanukkah to you both. I hope you and your families enjoy the holiday season before work starts up again for you both in earnest. Thank you, Ian. Kalen DeBoer is 24-2 at Washington, a mind-boggling 103-11 career as a head coach, and has been named National Coach of the Year by everyone but the University of Oregon student newspaper. I'm obviously in the bag for him, but regardless, where do you guys see him falling in your coach rankings in 2024? A little early peek into what we might be doing in March.
No, this is a good question. Have you thought about this before you saw this
I
question?
mean, well, I just would automatically say, without even doing a second of research, he will be in the top 10. It's just like, where in the top 10 will he be? Because he's absolutely right. Like, this, he won at Fresno State. He's wanting he won at NIA. He won at Fresno State. He's winning big at Washington. And you and I have both raved about, I mean, some of the play calls, some of the direct coaching decisions that have, allowed them to have this kind of success. Like, I absolutely think he's one of the best coaches in the country.
Yes, I will
It's
say
just, where
this.
am I going to put him?
I would be inclined to put him in the top six. There's another coach who I would also put in the top six who was in my top 10, but at 10, and that's Lance Leipold. I think I would have DeBoer in the top six with Leipold, obviously Saban, Kirby Smart, Jim Harbaugh, and Dabo.
Guys that I would definitely still keep ahead of him: Nick Saban, Kirby Smart. Not sure about Dabo. We'll think about that when the time comes. Brian Kelly, Harbaugh. And after that, I'm not saying he will come in right after that, but there's nobody after that that I'm like, definitely not. So, it's interesting. When you look at these, there's always somebody who, when you go to do it the next year, like, oof. How did I have this guy so high to begin with? But I know why I had him so high, but I have a feeling I'm gonna have to drop him quite a bit. Lincoln Riley was number five in my rankings last year.
Lincoln Riley was high on my list too. I don't think he was quite as high. He's probably seven, maybe. I think the hard part with, and Ryan Day kind of gets this too, but Lincoln Riley was seven. Yeah, was seven, which is he took over for Bob Stoops. Now, he was a really good assistant for Bob Stoops. He took over at Oklahoma, and that thing was, he did a great job with quarterbacks. But I think it's different when you're starting from scratch. And same thing with Ryan. I think Ryan's a really good offensive coach and he's done a really good job as a head coach, but he took the best things that Urban Meyer had. I know, like I get, I got a ton of pushback of having James Franklin above them when those guys are beating him. But James Franklin wasn't taking, he didn't take over for somebody that where it was rolling. And again, Kalen DeBoer, Jimmy Lake really struggled and that program had fallen apart. And that guy's 11-1 all time against top 25 opponents. And it wasn't like he took over programs that were on top of the world. So that's why I have him there. I mean, Leipold, we've talked a lot about, I mean, that guy's like, I hate to use the term miracle worker when it comes to college football coaches, but look what he's doing at Kansas. And look what he keeps doing wherever he goes. I don't know how many, like some of the other guys, I think they would do well at other places. Like we know what Harbaugh did at Stanford. Stanford was terrible when he got there. But the rest of the ones we're talking about, I'm not sure they could do as well.
I will at least give myself credit for writing this line in the Lincoln Riley blurb at the end. But number five could be his ceiling on this list, even for a career 835 coach, until he can field a team with a decent defense. Truer words never spoken. Mike from Boston, huge fan of the show for many years. Vandy has had three big moves this week. It's not often we get to talk about Vandy football, Bruce. They hired Tim Beck from New Mexico State as offensive coordinator, landed former Utah QB Nate Johnson in the portal, and are rumored to have hired Matt Ballas, former Notre Dame head strength coach, to fill the same role. Thoughts on these moves? Bruce, you once wrote an excellent article about Johnson after he competed in the Elite 11.
Nate Johnson is one of the fastest quarterbacks in the country, no doubt. We will see if he fits his system better and as he kind of keeps developing as a passer and reading defenses. Our colleague Joe Rexroad did an interesting story a couple of weeks back on Vandy and how people have really committed to ramping up the resources around that program. It's an interesting time for them because that is a really, really tough job, no secret. And I think, again, we were just talking about the top 25 coaching rankings. And again, James Franklin won there and got him in the top 25. Nobody's gotten close since then. And Clark Lee has had a very, I mean, I don't know. It's like, he's from there. I could understand and keep in mind, we talked about Lance Leipold. Lance Leipold interviewed for the job, interviewed well, but ultimately they went with the guy who played football there, is from Nashville, made a lot of sense, was a rising star assistant. But so far he has 2-22 in three SEC seasons. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to I think it's hard to believe that you're going to see a big improvement. I know some of those other things are positives, but man, it's an uphill climb there right now.
You know how every coach comes in and they're undefeated and the excitement is high and there's always something, this isn't going to go back a long ways, but you and I used to have a long before I even heard the word meme, a meme about puke buckets. There'd
Yeah.
always be a coach who took
It
over.
was from Mike Stoops.
Yeah, somebody always wrote the story about how much harder the guys are working. He's got them working so much harder than the last guy to the point where they had to put up puke buckets all around the weight room. Anyway, a more recent and more innocent example I think of is when Jeff Collins got to Georgia Tech. His whole big thing was Waffle House. I'm so Atlanta. I go to Waffle House every day. And it's like, well, that didn't turn out to be any indicator of him being able to be a good football coach or head coach. When Clark Lee got there, he made such a big deal out of handling recruiting and evaluation completely differently, right? And they hired Barton Simmons, 24/7's top recruiting guy, to work in the football. If we're going to do this a different way, we're going to, I mean, we know we can't beat a lot of these schools head to head, for the big name recruits, but we're just going to be kind of Moneyball, right? We're going to
And Barton,
get
like
better evaluated.
for context, like Barton played at Yale. He's from there, knew Clark Lee. He is really smart, and I think he was very good at what he did. And I think that was probably a wise hire. It's just
We just haven't seen the dividends yet. Like,
hard job. They've also lost some really good players in the portal in the last couple of years who, have gone on to other places. And you're like, ooh, that guy was a, like they've had some really good players. It's hard to keep them. And now maybe like as Rex Road's story indicated, maybe they'll be able to keep more of them.
yeah. Well, I always like to see them do well. Mitch Light, our one of our editors, recruiting guy. Diehard Vandy guy, Eric Single, another one of our editors. Like, when Vandy does well, our editor staff is happy. So I hope they get it figured out.
By the way, maybe not for the podcast. Never mind. This is not for the podcast. Keep going.
Here's kind of a technical question from Chris in Seattle. Regarding transfer portal players, when can these players actually start practicing playing with their new teams? Is it when a school term starts or is it immediately? Could some of these guys transferring in December play in a bowl game if it was after the start of the new semester? Example, UCLA winter quarter begins on January 3rd. If UCLA was in the playoffs and made it to the championship game on January 8th, could their transfers play in that game? The answer is no. But I'm not entirely, I'm not sure I fully understand the rule. Why do you?
I don't know, because I mean, you definitely remember recruits who can practice when they're already there, but it's different from competition in games. I can't think of an example that would fit into that.
So you're absolutely right about practice. I famously remember Jalen Hurts getting there to Alabama in time to be the scout team version of Deshaun Watson leading up to that year's championship. Championship game. And like I said earlier, there's already pictures of CJ Carr at Notre Dame's bowl practices. And this was even before he officially signed his letter of intent. I do know the reason. The rule is you have to be enrolled at school at the start of the season. So, for example, you may remember this was like a story for a week during the season. Clemson, Dabo Swinney convinced a guy who used to be his kicker. Who was, left Clemson and
It's a
was, I
business
forget,
school or something.
was in business, was getting ready to take a job on Wall Street, but he was enrolled in online classes at Clemson and therefore eligible to join the team midseason and play. That's different than somebody enrolling in the middle of the season or after the season's already started. So no, you cannot play in the bowl game or in the playoff. But you can practice. You can practice with the team. And the interesting thing about that is some of these, bowls that aren't as important, they almost become like a head start on spring practice. Like they can, some of these early enrollee guys can start getting real reps in December instead of having to wait till March or April.
Yes. All right.
Last thing we got, what was it, two weeks ago now, a week and a half ago, before Chris Peterson replaced me. We were talking about just when did the Heisman lose its prestige? When did it used to be such a big deal all season long? The TV ratings for the ceremony way down. And so a lot of people sent in some very thoughtful emails. 2009 came up a lot in terms of when Ndamukong Suh finished fourth, people kind of lost faith in the process, a couple other things. But I thought Nolan from Iowa, here's a very succinct and good point. When talking about the Heisman ceremony, I don't think the award has lost its significance. I believe the coverage of it has. Me personally, I don't care to watch ESPN and the cheesy stories and the coverage of it all. Add on to the fact that in the past 10 years, having a smartphone has become so common that I can wait until the coverage is over and get an alert on my phone as to who won. I don't need to suffer through an hour of ESPN's coverage in order to find out who won it when they win it. Can't argue with that, Bruce. It's an hour of, I mean, it's no offense to Chris Fowler, does a great job hosting it. ESPN's producers, I'm sure, put in a lot of hard work, but it is kind of 45 minutes of can we just get to the award already?
Yeah, I get it. I'm not going to disagree with that either. So.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, ultimately, like in 1997, Peyton Manning, Charles Woodson, one that we talked about, you absolutely had to watch that show to find out who won. So that has at least made a big difference in the TV ratings, but I still think that the whole season leading up to it, people just don't talk about or care as much about the Heisman. Next week we will come back on the 27th, and that's when things really get cranking when we get to some of the really good bowl games. I know that I will be joining you in LA for the Rose Bowl. I will be getting there on the 29th. So looking forward to that. But in the meantime, enjoy Christmas, enjoy some downtime, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
How did we get away with the things we used to do?